I don't know about you, but I'm almost always on autopilot when I drive around Leeds, and there are particular places I go, and I almost always use exactly the same routes without thinking about it or making a conscious decision. And that sometimes gets me to the wrong destinations, as my children will tell you. Are you like that? Most of the time, we don't consciously decide about things in life. We're on autopilot. We just do things by habit, instinct, and reaction. We don't really decide, we just do. So lots of the time we work on instinct or gut feel. We make judgments about a person's trustworthiness or their competence or aggressiveness or likability or attractiveness within the first 100 milliseconds of seeing a new face like this. Which of these faces do you prefer? Do you prefer the one on this side? Put your hand up. Do you prefer the one on this side? Yeah, that's very interesting, isn't it? The face on that side has been doctored to adjust the size and spacing of the eyes, the roundness of the face, and so on. Now, if we're aware of this kind of thing happening, we say we just knew it was a gut feel or an instinct. But first impressions do count for a lot. Now, there are some books around, like one called Blink by Malcolm Gladwell. You might have seen it in W.H. Smith, which suggests that we should make a lot more of our decisions on that basis, on our gut feel, in the blink of an eye. Is that right? When something happens to us, we often react without thinking. It happens in conversations, in relationships, in fights, in queues, when driving in traffic. We can choose to be reactive to our environment. For example, if the weather is good, we'll be happy. If the weather's bad, we'll be unhappy. If people treat us well, we will feel well. If they don't, we'll feel bad and become defensive. But we can also choose to be proactive and not to let the situation determine how we feel. So most of the time, we don't consciously decide. We just do. We get on with things by habit, instinct, and reaction. Now, this is what the Lord God Almighty says in Haggai. Consider your ways. Consider your ways. Think about how you are living. Other translations say, think carefully about how you're living. Give careful thought to your ways. And the context is specifically about lifestyle choices and decisions about things like money, food, clothes, drinking, work. Here it is in the message. Take a long, hard look at your life. Think it over. You have spent a lot of money, but you haven't much to show for it. You keep filling up your plates, but you never get filled up. You keep drinking and drinking and drinking, but you're always thirsty. You put on layer after layer of clothes, but you can't get warm. And the people who work for you, what are they getting out of it? Not much. A leaky, rusted-out bucket. That's what. Got some quite sharp words there. Consider your ways is the first phrase in the language I like to use. How can we do that? Does it mean we have to consciously think through every item in the shopping basket every time and insert long pauses in every conversation so that we can carefully think through our responses? Well, fortunately not. That would make life incredibly slow and mentally challenging. But there are times when a little more effort needs to go into decision-making. A unique ability that sets humans apart from animals is our level of self-awareness and the ability to choose how to respond to any stimulus. The ability to choose our response is our response ability. Aha. Animals don't have independent will. They respond to a stimulus like a computer responds to a program. They're not aware of the programming, and they don't have the ability to change it, but we do. We have the ability to choose how we respond to stimuli. We are able to make decisions to improve our lives and influence things rather than simply reacting to forces. And God says, consider your ways. Not only do we have a response ability, we also have the responsibility to deal with that properly. Come on. There we are. Responsibility. Consider your ways, says God. If you think about your life, about life even 100 years ago, people had very little choice, and the number of decisions they faced was smaller than we have today. It's the wealth and the culture of our society that means we are presented with choices and opportunities all the time, and we have to make decisions. Some of them are big, life-changing decisions. Some are apparently small, trivial decisions. Some are easy, some are difficult, some affect us, some affect others. Some are about doing, some are about being. So what decisions do you have to make as you go about your life? Time for some interaction. I wonder if you could turn to a neighbour or a couple of neighbours and just think about that question that's on the screen. What types of decision do you have to make as you go about your life? I'll give you just a couple of minutes and I'll get some people to shout them out and we'll put them on the flip chart. What types of decisions do you make as you go about your life? Here's a little quote you might like. It's not on the screen. I believe the single most significant decision I can make on a day-to-day basis is my choice of attitude. Somebody mentioned it, didn't they? It's far more important than my past, my education, my bankroll, my successes, failures, fame or pain, and what other people think or say of me. Attitude keeps me going or cripples my progress. It fuels my fire or assaults my hope. When my attitudes are right, there's no barrier too high, no valley too deep, no dream too extreme, no challenge too great for me. That one's by Chuck Swindoll. In this talk, I'm going to concentrate on a few of the things the Bible says about wisdom in decision-making. It's only part of the story. I realize it's a very big topic, decision-making. David Flowers is doing a couple more talks, as you know, next month. I'm also going to take a bit of a look at some of the psychology of decision-making. Does it agree with the Bible? So as part of the preparation for the talk, I decided to read the whole book of Proverbs in one sitting, partly to see if I could do it. It took 35 minutes to read 31 chapters, so I read pretty fast. You might like to try it. But to start with, it seems very bitty and jumbled up to me. I don't know if you've had a look at it. A bit like this, like these Smarties. In fact, this is one of those magic eye illusions where if you stare at it long enough, then a pattern emerges. Unfortunately, my science tells me that it won't work for you sitting at that distance from the screen, so I'm going to have to cheat. Keep looking. Ha-ha. Anyhow. The pattern I noticed in Proverbs, after reading chapter after chapter, were these big sections saying how wonderful wisdom is. That's the core. And then there are lots of sections with all jumbled up, different colored, if you like, sections of things about specific topics. And just like sorting the Smarties by color, you could sort of do this. Cue PowerPoint. There you go. And here's some of the themes that I saw cropping up again and again. For example, trust in the Lord when making decisions. Your emotions affect your decisions. Get some advice. I won't read them all, but you can see some of them. I'm just going to pick five themes, and we'll see how many I get through this morning. I'll do more this evening if necessary. Let's see what they are. Ask God for wisdom. Assess systematically. I couldn't find short words for that, but that's what I want to say. Be aware of your biases, face your fears, and time decisions well. So the first one is, ask God for wisdom. And here's one of those proverbs. A man is foolish to trust only himself, but those who use God's wisdom are safe. And then there's another verse in James which says, if any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given you. I can see some of you mouthing this, these verses. They're very familiar for some people. That's great. It's a good one to remember that. Now, there's a spectrum of opinion among Christians about God's involvement in our decision-making. Cue spectrum. I'll tell you, both extremes. At one end, there's the detailed guidance view, which says that God has a detailed plan for your life, and if you're a good Christian, you'll be able to discern it in every detail. And that's how you should make decisions. At the other end, the other extreme, there's the wisdom-only point of view, which says that God has revealed his moral will through the Bible, and so long as you're within that, you're entirely free to choose and use the principles of wisdom to help you decide. St. Augustine said, love God and do as you like. So there's two extreme points of view. And theologians like to argue this point. And I've been reading the books, which seem to take one position or the other and argue all the time. The best I can conclude at the minute is it's a bit of both. We have a relationship with God as Father. And like any good father with his children, he wants us to grow to maturity and be able to make our own decisions, wise decisions by ourselves. And he gives a lot of freedom for us to do that. But God is also the king, And sometimes he wants particular things to happen, and he is in control. So in some way, it's a bit of both, is my conclusion at the minute. We need to listen both to wisdom and to God's voice in the moment. And here's a story to illustrate this issue. We wanted to move house a few years ago, and this is my son's picture of his dream house. We found a house we liked. We put an offer in, and after some negotiation, we eventually got it accepted. And the vendor then gave us a very short time to sell our house, so we were under pressure. We'd realized that the new house would require quite a lot of work. And my work, my business work at the time, took me away from home 3 days a week. And we had two much younger children who took lots of our energy. I'm not saying they still don't. Around church, we had barely any staff. So a lot of the time was of our time was consumed in planning and running events. So the dilemma was that we were very keen to move somewhere else, but also not certain the impact of all the extra work would have on us. And so we were in a meeting, a small group meeting. I can't remember if it was a house group or if it was a leaders meeting. And they prayed for us. And after we'd prayed, Ruth Parsons, who now lives in Bury St. Edmunds, some of you will remember her, she said she had the impression, she thought was from God, that everything was okay and we had done all the wise things and that the Lord was saying we had the freedom to choose. Isn't that interesting? It's as if we were asking God to decide for us. And he was saying, no, you choose. And I think there are some things, many things, even big things, where God wants us to have freedom and maturity to choose. On that occasion, we actually chose to withdraw our offer and told the estate agent not to sell our house. And some years later, another house came on the market. And some of you came to the housewarming party, so you know what happened with that one. We're very happy, actually, with both the decisions we made. So ask God for wisdom. You might get detailed guidance, but you'll certainly get wisdom. He's promised that he'll give you wisdom. So the second topic is assess systematically. Here's a verse for you. Every prudent man acts out of knowledge. And another one. How stupid to decide before knowing the facts. Deliberately said that in an Irish accent to make my wife laugh. Get the facts at any price. And Jesus says, in some decisions, like following him, need careful thought. And here's the quote from Jesus. Suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Will he not first sit down and estimate the cost to see if he's enough money to complete it? There's lots of encouragement in the Bible, not just those bits, to look at the facts and assess your decisions systematically. Now here's an insight from psychology. A human can only hold a small number of ideas in his mind at one time. If we were computers, our memory cache would be small. We don't find it easy to consider everything at once, and one way to deal with that is to write things down. Benjamin Franklin had the idea of making a list of pros and cons. Many of you do that? Ah, interesting, only a few. I remember doing this the second time we were moving house because there were so many things to consider. And at risk, I'm going to show you this. I say at risk because I've shown a couple of people this, and there's been a strong reaction to seeing this little sort of table of pros and cons. You can just see that some of the words are in red, meaning that was a bad thing about our old house, and in green, that would be a good thing about the new house. I'm moving swiftly on to the next one so that you can't see too much detail. There we go. Oh, you can't really see. But down the right-hand side, you see lots of green and a few bits of red. So we actually knew that there were some downsides to the new house that we were moving to. That helped us make our decision. The strength of reaction was, Sally said, I hated doing that. My colleague from work, who came around last night because he'd been looking at a draft of the talk, he said, when I did that, I had a much more sophisticated spreadsheet. It had columns for the weighting and the score, and then we multiplied them together and added them up. And my partner hated it too. But Sally said, looking back on it, it did give her a chance to be able to explain the reasons why, the main reasons why, because you can't hold all those things in your head at once. The basic thing of making a list of pros and cons. Here's a different example. Some lovely people on screen here with the kids just at the moment. Many people do marriage preparation classes, but Richard and Sally took a pre-engagement course in private with a married couple that they really respected. And they systematically looked at lots of angles on the idea of getting engaged and married. And their thinking was, well, by the time we've got engaged, the decision's made, and that's a bit late. And I think that's quite an unusual and radical approach, and I like it. But it's one of those things about assessing your decisions systematically. So there's your first two suggestions. Ask God for wisdom. Assess systematically. And thirdly, be aware of your biases. And who is influencing you as you consider your decisions. The prophet Jeremiah points out this. The heart is deceitful above all things and beyond cure. Who can understand it? Quite often we make decisions, but not for the reasons we think we do. Our behavior can be quite irrational, even when we think we're being totally rational about a decision. Very often people don't realize what's influencing their decisions. Let me illustrate with a couple of examples. Here's a little chart. This is the statistics of the percentage of drivers in various countries who have agreed for their organs to be donated in the event of a fatal accident. You can see there's a huge difference between the countries in Group A on the left, like ours, at a few percent, and those in Group B on the right, which are all above 85%. Why is that? The difference is very strong, even between apparently similar countries like Sweden and Denmark, or Germany and Austria, and the Netherlands and Belgium. Huge difference. So here is the difference. On the driver registration forms in countries in Group A, they were asked to tick a question like this, to say they wanted to join the organ donor program. The wording wasn't exactly the same because, of course, it was in their language. In Group B, the question was like this. They were asked if they wanted to opt out to not join the donor program. And when complex questions are presented like this, what happens is most people in Group A don't check the box and don't join. And most people in Group B don't tick the box and do join. We tend to stick with the default. And that's why the wording of surveys and questionnaires and opt-out clauses really matters. Who had the most influence on these decisions? The person who wrote the form. Each of the people who filled in the forms probably felt they were making a completely free decision. And in a similar situation, you would probably think that too. But in fact, it's a bit of a thinking illusion. The wording of the question by the person who wrote it has far more influence than you could possibly imagine. Here's another example. We think we're consistent in our decision making, but look at this. For a while, The Economist had a special offer on their US website. Subscribe to the online version for $59, or to the print subscription for $125. And if you want them both, it costs you $125. So some psychologists did an experiment. They asked a number of people which one they would choose. And here are the results. 16% went for the online subscription, 0% went for print only, and 84% went for both. Very rational, you think, who would go for the middle option? So they did the experiment again, and this time they took out that middle option that was obviously useless. And this time the results were 68% wanted the online subscription and 32% went for the print and web option. Isn't that interesting? You would have thought that the middle option was completely useless because nobody wanted it, but in fact it changed the perceptions of the other two options and totally changed the outcomes. It's called the decoy effect. When we can see that one thing is better than something else, we tend to think it's better than all the other options. So the psychologists are agreeing with Jeremiah. There's actually loads of examples. The heart is deceitful. Very often we are fooled. In fact, psychologists have identified at least 19 biases and things that can influence your decisions and make you predictably irrational. There's a couple of popular books, those pictures you'll find in the bookshops, that explain some of those ideas. Ask them for Christmas. Because actually, I don't have time to go through all of those and explain them and so on. But I think it's important to become aware of our biases and our influences. We discussed some of them at Thinking Aloud a couple of weeks ago, and we'll be doing more on Friday week when we're going to have a look at Darren Brown's illusions and how he manipulates us. You're all welcome to come to that. So what's going on here? We don't know our preferences very well. So when we're asked the question, we're susceptible to biases and influences, and we find it very hard to accept that we're so influenced. And that's why companies pay money to advertising agencies to influence you in ways that you don't suspect. We're deliberately manipulated in many ways. The Bible would say something like, "The God of this age has blinded our minds." So what do we do about that? The Bible says, "Take every thought captive to make it obedient to Christ." In our day when manipulation is so deliberate, I think we need to train ourselves to be aware of our biases and influences. So ask God for wisdom, assess systematically, and be aware of your biases and influences. And the next point is, face your fears. Here's a proverb about fear. "A person's fear sets a trap for him, but one who trusts the Lord is safe." Now, so here's some insights from psychology. We're not very good at estimating risk. We often make decisions based on our fear of what might happen. And the influence of this kind of fear in human behavior was most graphically illustrated in the US after the terrorist attacks of the 11th of September 2001. Throughout the following 12 months, many Americans chose to drive rather than take domestic flights. In fact, driving the length of a domestic flight in the US, which are typically 1,157 kilometers, is 65 times riskier than flying. And as a result, the number of people killed in road accidents over that year rose by about 1,600 people, illustrated by this red graph, which is above the average level of road traffic deaths in the US. In attempting to avoid a potentially grisly fate, they leapt out of the frying pan and into the fire. Other studies have shown we make bad decisions when it comes up to weighing the risks of versus benefits of being screened for cancer or having our kids vaccinated against the swine flu. They've just released it in New York, and there's a very high proportion of the parents are not willing for their children to have the vaccination against the swine flu. And we're very poor at judging the risks of everything from nuclear power to climate change. So one source of our fear is our difficulty in understanding statistics. Most of us don't know what to think about statistics, because we all know that there's lies, damned lies, and statistics. So we don't know quite what to believe. Even on the church forums this week, many of you will have seen a discussion about the safety of margarine and butter, for example. And it's very difficult to get an accurate perspective on risk. We tend to react out of fear. Alternatively, if you're a teenager, you fear nothing other than the fear of being unfashionable. And that's because you're unable to see the consequences of risky behavior. And it's partly because of the developmental changes that are going on in the brain at that age. Whatever age you are, we're bad at estimating risk. Just at some ages, it's more obvious. Another major factor in our decisions is the way things get imprinted on our memory, which I need to explain. One reason we overestimate the likelihood of being killed in a plane crash, shark attack, or terrorist attack is the extensive and graphic media coverage that makes such events very easy to picture. We similarly underestimate the likelihood of dying from diseases because news of these kinds of deaths is generally presented in terms of statistics, like the previous slide, rather than sensational images, rather like the one I showed you just a moment ago. Our memories play a very strong role in our decision-making, and in particular, we have a great capacity to recall graphic imagery. And this is what psychologists call availability bias. The more easily you can bring to mind or imagine an event, the more likely you think it is to happen. And it's largely driven by feelings. So memories of emotional or vivid situations like 9/11 are the most easily recalled. And so if you go to the airport, you'll take off your shoes, you'll hand in your water bottles, and it's actually a theater of security to try to reduce our fears. But on the other hand, when driving in our cars, we think relatively little about answering the phone or speeding in a residential area, which are actually much more risky situations. When considering a decision, we imagine how the outcomes of our choice will make us feel and what the emotional consequences of our actions will be. We usually plump for the option we think will make us happiest overall. However, the emotional consequences of most events are less intense and briefer than most people imagine. It really isn't as bad as we thought. And actually, the pleasure from that treat doesn't seem to last as long either. We tend to think that a loss will hurt more than a corresponding gain will please, and the prospect of loss gives us twice the emotional response as the prospect of gains. And so we take big risks to avoid losses, notably in the stock market, but also in simple things like repairing an old failing car over and over again because we don't want to lose the money that we've already put into it. So fear influences our decisions. We're bad at estimating risk. We fear things imprinted on our memory, and we worry about how bad it's going to feel if it should happen. So here's a quiz for you. That's a quiz. How many times do you think the Bible tells us, do not worry? Or can you think of any one or two or whatever? Can you think of a time when it says something like that? Cast all your anxieties onto him. This is great. Keep going. The one with the sparrows. The one with the sparrows, yes. Yeah, they don't worry about what they're going to eat or what they're going to wear, and God looks after them. Don't worry about.
It's that one about don't worry what you wear.
Don't worry about what you wear, yes.
The same as the lilies, yeah.
Angels everywhere say don't fear. I'm repeating these for the tape, by the way. I don't even know if it's being recorded. Tomorrow will take care of itself. Don't worry about tomorrow. Those are great ones, yeah. So there are actually 11 places in the Bible where it says, do not worry. And what about when it says, do not fear? I think we've had lots of angels saying, do not fear. Guess me a number then. Come on, bid me a number.
77.
That's pretty close, actually. Let's see. 83 times. Very good. So it's a big theme in the scriptures, do not fear. They're interesting commands, aren't they? You're commanded not to worry and not to fear, and yet we experience them as feelings and tend to think, well, I'm just having a feeling of this. And God will do the fearing for you. That's an interesting way to see it as well, isn't it? So another time we can talk about this in more depth, but today, if you're worried about something, or fear what might happen, particularly regarding a decision, let me encourage you to ask God, or later on to ask someone to pray for you. And they can ask God to give you wisdom to see things in a true perspective, not full of fear, to calm those unsettled feelings, and then to give you courage to do the right thing. And I think that's what our prayer should be in this area. Okay, so let's move on and look at the fifth of my points, which I've sort of skipped around. Timing your decisions well. Some people are more decisive than others. Let's have a quick show of hands. If you find it easy to make decisions, you quickly put up your hand. Amazing. Good. Now, if you reckon you're slow to make decisions, you can think for a while about whether or not to put up your hand. Well, what's the wise thing to do? As far as I can see, the godly wisdom seems to be that if you're impulsive and fast to decide, let's see, then God says, consider your ways. It's as if he's saying, slow down. But if you're indecisive or slow to decide, it's speed up. And he says, you know, when Elijah is asking the people on the mountain, and they're considering who to follow as true God, he says, how long will you waver between two opinions? So we've got both messages, and I think that's because we are quite sort of polarized in some ways, because when I've asked this question, people are either decisive or they feel they're indecisive, and I think there's a message regardless of which way around you think you are. The more choices we have, the more likely we are to do nothing. Often there's paralysis by analysis. So The longer you delay, the less likely you are to get over the hesitation, and the more the options will close down. There are lots of studies that have been done in psychology to show that kind of stuff. But here's a couple of quotes I like. This is from the chap, Bevan, who set up the National Health Service in the UK. He said, "We know what happens to people who stay in the middle of the road. They get run over." And then Theodore Roosevelt, he said, "In any moment of decision, the best thing you can do is the right thing. The next best thing you can do is the wrong thing, and the worst thing you can do is nothing." So interesting quotes, and all encouraging us probably to make more decisions and make our decisions quicker. But I think it depends on your personality. Time the decision well, neither dithering nor rushing. The strange thing is that people devote the same time to thinking about large decisions as they do, but small decisions, particularly purchases. Some people spend a lot of time, others people spend not much time, but it doesn't seem to matter how big the decision is. And there are two words, maximizers and satisficers, which describe a bit about how that decision goes on. And they are real words, honest. Bit strange. A maximizer is like a perfectionist, someone who needs to be assured that every purchase or decision is the best that could have been made. The way a maximizer knows for certain is to consider all the alternatives they can imagine. Maximizers want to make the best possible choice, the optimum decision. So even if they find a walking route or meet an eligible man that would seem to meet their requirements, they can't make a decision until after they've examined every option so they know they're making the best possible choice. The alternative to maximizing is to be a satisficer. A satisficer has criteria and standards. But a satisficer is not worried about the possibility that there might be something better. As soon as they find the bank account, the holiday, the university course, or the girl that has the qualities they want, they're satisfied. So which are you? And it might be different in different situations. What about clothes shopping? Do you walk around the shop several times considering all the alternatives? Let's see your hands. Or do you take the first option that meets your criteria? Okay, so we've got a spread of opinion there. Normally, I hate clothes shopping, and I'm the ultimate satisficer in that area. The first thing that fits... Oh, dear. I just realized. However, I found myself online one evening spending probably hours trying to find the best purple shoelaces for my daughter's trainers. Now, she got the best laces, and I got the best bargain for her. But what a lot of time and exhaustion to spend £1.99. What about the last time you decided where to live? Did you go for an exhaustive search of every possible property, or did you go for the first one that met your criteria? Interesting. The observation is that maximizers use lots of time and energy and exhaust themselves making decisions. And then they're anxious about the decisions they made. Was it the best one? Satisficers decide quickly and are happier with their decisions afterwards. There's a book called The Paradox of Choice by a guy called Schwartz. And it says that if you consider all those factors, in fact, if you want to be a maximizer, your best strategy is to be a satisficer, because you'll be happier in the long run. So here's a practical suggestion. Instead of exhaustively trawling through the websites and catalogues in search of your ideal digital camera or garden barbecue or Christmas present, try asking a friend if they're happy with theirs, and if they are, it'll probably do for you too. And I've actually tried this a couple of times, and I'm absolutely delighted with it as a decision-making mechanism. It's crazy. Far too long. Here are a couple of Bible verses that echo similar thoughts. Oh, no, I'm only going to do one. This is my favorite, actually. I wish Sally kept telling me, say more about this, but I'm just going to read it to you. It's 1 Timothy 6:6. And it says that godliness with contentment is great gain. And that's something that's been going through my head for weeks now as I've been preparing this. And I just have come to really value contentment. in the context of godliness, and that's my prayer for you. One more thing that affects the timing of our decisions is choosing not to make decisions in the heat of our emotions. There are lots of proverbs about how our emotions and moods affect our decision-making. For example, this one: a quick-tempered man does foolish things. And recent studies confirm that men, but not women, interestingly, gamble more when they're angry. And also there's another one that shows that angry people are less generous. And various other ones that show a time of high emotion is not necessarily a good time to make a decision. Making decisions under stress and full of emotion causes inflexible thinking. The sensations of romantic love can lead to quite irrational behaviour. Abnormal decision-making is also a feature of common neuropsychiatric conditions, substance abuse, manic depression, dementia, and personality disorder. Here's some advice from Robert Schuller. Never cut down a tree in the wintertime. Never make a decision in the low time. Never make your most important decision when you're in the worst moods. Wait, be patient. The storm will pass. The spring will come. So, things that help affect the timing of our decisions are the whether you are decisive or indecisive, whether you're a maximizer or a satisficer, and what kind of mood and how that's affecting your decision. So I'm going to wrap up now just by concluding. I'm not going to do the other 2 points that I did this morning. We live most of our lives by instinct, habit, and reaction. And God says, consider your ways, and wants us to make those into godly and wise habits. You can choose your response to any situation, and that's a responsibility. And you came up with lots of kinds of decisions that we made on the flip chart. So when you're making decisions, one of these decisions, here are the pointers, and there'll be more in the next couple of talks. The first one is ask God for wisdom. You might get specific guidance, but you'll definitely get wisdom. I skipped over the pros and cons thing of assessing systematically, and I skipped over all the psychology of understanding how we are deceived and our biases and our influences. But then I talked quite a bit about facing your fears. Do not be afraid. Do not worry. I talked about timing your decisions well. Maximize by satisficing. Decide out of the heat of emotion. So just to finish, this is my prayer for you. May God give you wisdom as you consider your ways. May you have patience to assess your decisions systematically. And may you have insight into your biases and the things that influence you. May you have courage to face your fears and good judgment in timing your decisions well. May God increase your wisdom and grow in you godliness and contentment, because that is great gain.